Hello, listeners of KKFI in Kansas City and from around the world. Today on Radioactive Magazine, we begin with a program we call The Voice of Palestine. Today, we will be interviewing a Palestinian-American, Ibrahim, and he will explain some of his observations about the conflict. As many of our listeners know, a painful situation has existed in Palestine and Israel for the past 70 years. Painful for all sides, Arabs, Jews, Muslims, and Christians, Israelis, and Palestinians. 70 years ago, in 1948, Israel declared itself a nation. 70 years ago, in 1948, most Arabs living in the area fled in terror in what many Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe. Then, in 1967, many more Palestinians were pushed out of the region after neighboring nations engaged in warfare with the Israeli military. Events in 1948 and beyond created communities of Palestinian refugees, some in the Palestinian territories of Gaza and the West Bank, some in neighboring Jordan and Lebanon. Some Palestinians eventually fled to the United States. Palestinian refugees now live here in the United States, barred from returning to their homes in Palestine. Next week, on Thursday, October 25th, the public has an opportunity to view the documentary, A Jewish Eyewitness in Palestine. This is a presentation by author and activist Anna Balzer about her observations when she lived in the West Bank. The film provides a visual explanation of the many challenges, checkpoints, and roadblocks facing Palestinians in the West Bank. Today, we will hear about these challenges from a Palestinian American living in Kansas City. Ibrahim is an American citizen born from Palestine refugee parents. Ibrahim's grandparents were refugees twice over, his great-grandparents, rather. Once they were pushed out in 1967 and again, pushed out in 1948 and again in 1967. His father was born and raised in Amman, Jordan. His mother was born in Tukarem in the West Bank, a city occupied since the 67 war and now exclusively populated by Palestinian refugees. Ibrahim still has family in the Palestinian territories and in Jordan. So welcome to Radioactive Magazine, Ibrahim.
Thank you, Jamie. Glad to be here and hope I can make a difference through this interview.
All right. So I know that when we talked earlier, you said that you have visited family in the area a couple of times. It's been a while. But I wonder if you could talk about where you went and what circumstances you observed in the Palestinian territories.
Certainly. Of course, having family in both Jordan and the West Bank in Palestine, usually we would begin our journey in Jordan. In Amman, where my father's family lives. My father was born and raised there, and we have numerous family members in the refugee camps there. Most prominent is Al-Wahdat, is where many of our people from our village, Al-Qubab, ended up living and finding their way there.
That's a particularly large refugee camp, am I right?
Correct. One of the largest Palestinian refugee camps, not just in Jordan, but among refugee camps worldwide,
okay.
Among Palestinians. My mother's side, of course, Olympi Hussein Bridge into the West Bank to the city of Jericho or Ariha, where most Palestinians coming from Jordan enter the West Bank through. Of course, this on its own is an ordeal, which I'll explain in a little bit. Generally, to get to Tul Kerem from Ariha, you face numerous challenges in not only checkpoints from the roadblocks from the Palestinian Authority and security checks, but certainly a larger portion from the Israeli occupying forces and the settler infrastructure that has been chewed out of the West Bank, where specific roads that cut through villages and farmlands have been made, and for Jewish or Israeli exclusive buses and passengers and transport and freight. Certainly, the last time I visited, we faced the challenge of having to reroute our how we got to my mom's home city of Tul Kerem, due to the fact that settlers were blocking the roads and stopping any Palestinian, anybody who could be identified as a Palestinian or had Palestinian tags on their vehicle.
Okay, and I just want to clarify, those were settlers themselves who were blocking it, not the Israeli military?
Correct, exactly. So the Israeli military would actually force us to reroute our direction simply to accommodate these settlers mm-hmm. and their movements across the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Further, you know, this would be, this was on the first day arriving from Jericho. You know, throughout my visit, my last visit, we also went to the cities of Nablus and Ramallah, as well as some of the villages in between.
Those and are all in the West Bank, right?
Correct, in the West Bank. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Ramallah, you could say, is the more well-known city to most Americans,
mm-hmm.
And where the seat of the PA, mm-hmm. Palestinian Authority, sits. So even going from city to city, we faced numerous checkpoints, checkpoints were a daily occurrence. Required us to, one, you know, show ID, somewhat be interrogated by those forces, asking where we're going, who we're going to see, and certainly, help being an American and having that American passport certainly reduced a lot of that flack, but. Nonetheless, we face some of that discrimination, especially having other Palestinians with us who did not carry that American citizen or have American citizenship. Certainly, it made you aware of how you wanted to plan your day. Say you're going from Tul Kerem to Nablus. Midway, you'd face the checkpoints, and if you left at a certain time and they were closed, they'd turn you back. And certainly I experienced this on my trip. However, many of my cousins and relatives overseas experience it every day as they try to commute to work or to commute to some of the universities in, for example, in Ramallah is the American University of Birzeit, where many of my cousins went and are going, and the one of the oldest universities in historic Palestine. And
they had trouble getting there because of the checkpoints.
Exactly. The checkpoints, not only is it a inconvenience and a waste of their time, but it humiliates them every day as they go when, you know, other people, other Israeli settlers can move freely across the West Bank, even though they are there illegally, and we Palestinians there illegally. It wastes their financial their finances. It costs money. They either have to take a taxi or find a bus or some sort of other sort of means to travel. And the destination is not always guaranteed.
Right. So let's just point out, if we could, that some of the roads are reserved for settlers and some of the transportation, the buses, are reserved for settlers. And Palestinians are excluded. Is that right?
Correct. Many of the road transportation infrastructure, whether it's and public transportation, is you could even say segregated. And I would, you know, say even similar to that in the 60s here with African Americans, and how Palestinians are seen as a threat and a nuisance. In the eyes of many especially Israeli settlers. And
although, of course, blacks in the South could sit in the back of the bus, and
certainly.
The Palestinians aren't allowed on the bus.
Exactly. Palestinians, the excuse is that Palestinians are a security threat.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, this has been the excuse not only when it comes to buses, not only when it comes to the transportations, but when it comes to the reason of having settlements in the eyes of Israel is that it's for their national security. Mm-hmm. The reason for bombing Gaza is for their national security. The reason for preventing Palestinians from moving and moving across the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza and elsewhere, as any other human being should, is for in the name of national security.
Right, right. Let's return. I want to explore a little bit more about your great-grandfather. He lived in Greater Palestine before 1948, your paternal great-grandfather.
Correct. Could
you talk a little bit about what his occupation was and what happened to the land after 1948?
Yes. So my great-grandfather, Mahmoud, was born and raised among a lot of my other relatives in the village of Al-Qubab in what is now Israel, between the cities of Ramla and Lid. This was a major railroad station in historic Palestine, and it was a major agricultural center. And being so, my father, my great-grandfather, was one of many fallahin, or farmers, that lived and worked off the land, whether that was farming or raising livestock, tending to olive groves or fruit groves, and certainly what even today is considered the dairy center of even modern day Israel.
Okay. All right. So he fled in 1948, and where did he go then?
So in 1948, Al-Qubab was ethnically cleansed from the from Palestine, among hundreds of other villages. From Al-Qubab in the summer of 1948, my great-grandparents and my grandmother, among other relatives, fled to the city of Ariha, Jericho, in the West Bank. Of course, if you're any even somewhat familiar with the events of 1948, you're aware of the numerous massacres and forced disappearances and crimes against humanity that have still not been shown the light in the international arena, nor acknowledged by the State of Israel.
I want to read. In a recent NPR interview of a academic who lives in a Palestinian who lives in Lebanon now, he was asked about whether the Palestinians recognize want a two-state solution, and do they recognize Israel? And his response was, "Well, I think the Israeli government today is the most right-wing in Israel's history, and the government is openly and publicly and unashamedly opposed to Palestinian statehood." So I wonder what your experience with that has been.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we keep hearing this idea of a two-state solution for the Palestinian people, and maybe at one time it was possible, but certainly recent events and the events for the last two decades have turned that possibility almost to an impossibility. Certainly, I would say if there was a chance for peace, the best chance was after 1948, in that the crimes of 1948 could have been recognized and resolved in 1948. However, instead, the international community, the supporters of the Zionist movement and the State of Israel have continued to deny Palestinians their rights to land and preserving their culture and historic, them being the indigenous population of that land all the way till today. However, there was a breakthrough during the first Intifada or uprising, in which the Palestinian people, for the first time, wanted to take their political situation into their own hand and formed a nonviolent movement against the Israeli occupation. And this resulted in and allowed for what is known as the Oslo negotiations.
Right. And I want to follow up on that, but we're going to take a short break now for our pledge drive. Okay, we are back now with our guest, Ibrahim, who is a Palestinian-American living in Kansas City, who has a family who still resides in the Palestinian territories and has been to Palestine and made observations about the situation there. So thank you, Ibrahim. We want to return to the subject of the Intifada, which was in 1987, and what followed in the 90s with the Oslo Accords. And what were your thoughts about that?
Correct. You could say that we, especially I, am part of the, you could say, Oslo generation. And Oslo, certainly, especially to international viewers, seemed like the greatest thing in the world. Certainly after Oslo was a response to this nonviolent movement that began by in the West Bank and Gaza and all across historic Palestine to form a voice for the Palestinian people who are still living under occupation since 1948 and 1967. The idea behind Oslo was an agreement between what the one recognizing the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, as the representatives of the Palestinian people. But it came at the cost of giving the voice of Palestine the diversity that exists in Palestine. The deals were made among members of the PLO in which they would have have an increase in autonomy within the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. However, the reality that came to be is that this only formed a corrupt bureaucracy that manages the Palestinian people in the occupied territories in the name of securing their rights, but rather plays an important role in doing the dirty work for the Israeli government and the occupation. And so the guarantee of Oslo really was that in time there would be greater autonomy for the Palestinian people, greater freedoms for the Palestinian people, rights to representation, to develop infrastructure, to develop a civil and political society that is the right of every sovereign nation, of every sovereign people. Instead, this turned into a power grab by the occupation, and resulted in the failure of Oslo that showed itself in during the Second Intifada in 2000, and the rise of you could even say a more violent backlash in the West Bank and other occupied territories. And the products we've seen since the Second Intifada are simply continuations of this frustration that we as a Palestinian people have not been given a chance to speak for ourselves, that have not been given a chance to form our civil society, our government, and instead our fate has been given to a group of corrupt elites in Palestinian society and the Israeli occupation and the people supporting that occupation internationally. The point I really want to focus on during my interview is that the Palestinian people have never been given a voice and a chance to represent themselves. Even prior to the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, the partition of Palestine was a decision taken by the United Nations without the will of the Palestinian people, and disregarded their needs and their rights as the indigenous population of Palestine, Palestine being the region, and a region full of diverse cultures, microcultures and religions. As I always say, if Israel is the land for Jews, if it's a land of Zionism, Palestine is a land of Christians, Muslims, and Jews. It's for all religions. It's the land of Abraham, and a land based and unified by its ties to Abraham and the monotheistic religions. Palestinians are Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Many of them have been separated and forced in exile because of this conflict. And as a result, the international community has failed to support a diverse and representative voice for the Palestinian people. Certainly, the PLO, at one point, there was hope that the PLO would represent the Palestinian people. However, we'll stop right there. Let me collect
fine.
My thoughts.
Do you need to take another break for the... Okay, well, to go on, I would like to explore the whole question of whether in the eventual goal should be one state or two state. That's usually the way that the question is put. And in the interview on NPR that I talked about earlier, the Palestinian said he doesn't care whether there's one state or two state. He doesn't care what it's called. He is just focused on getting the political, cultural, economic rights of Palestinians restored, their life prospects restored, so that they can study, go abroad, do whatever they want without having to get Israeli permission. So I wonder what your thoughts are on this. Do you believe that there should be one Palestine?
Just to go back a little bit, the question of a two-state solution really isn't, is a two-state solution or one-state solution right or the answer to the problem? The problem, since Oslo, the two-state solution has failed. We've reached the point in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict where the two-state solution is no longer feasible. There's no way to guarantee a Palestinian state and the rights of Palestinians culturally, economically, their education, their rights to live, their rights to move, their rights, their prospects, as you mentioned, without in the current situation. This is why very much I say that the only solution left is a one-state solution. And the reason that is we've gone beyond this point to guarantee those rights. At this point, Palestinians have to call for their representation within the occupied territories as well as Israel proper. The reality is Israel is a colonialist Zionist movement that has come to colonize the Palestinian land, the region of Palestine. This region is a land of, as I say, the conquered and the conqueror. We Palestinians are a mix of those who were conquered and the conquerors that have come to this land since the beginning of time. We make up a diverse, whether Arab or Turk or African or white or European, whether Christian, Muslim, or Jew, we are all Palestinians. And recognizing that fact and being united as Palestinians requires a one-state solution. Israel currently defines itself as a Zionist state for Jews, where the Jewish population serve as the elite. Even within the Jewish system, Jews of African descent, of Middle Eastern descent, of other places in the world who are not white, who are not European, face the same discrimination that we, the Palestinian people, have suffered through and have undergone since 1948. Only by recognizing them and absorbing them as Palestinians can we find peace in the region. The reason I say Palestinians and not Israelis is the fact that recognizing the name Israel or the state of Israel vindicates and allows and allows the past aggressions and crimes against us, the Palestinian people, to live on. So with this cause, a two-state solution is no longer possible.
Right. So what you're saying is that we should emphasize the land, the area of Palestine, as a place for all people, Jews, Muslims, Christians, and by avoiding the name Israel, we can rectify the damage that's been done over the last 70 years.
Exactly. In order to rectify what's happened, we must recognize that the Palestinian people are a diverse people that will absorb what they call the Israeli people into become Palestinians, and that these people in a one-state solution must share the same rights, same values, and respect each other regardless of race or religion as Palestinians, united as Palestinians. This is the only long-term solution. A independent Palestinian state side by side with an Israeli Palestinian state can never exist because of the past transgressions and the power balance that has always existed between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Palestinians have always been victimized by the Israeli aggression, while Israel has been supported internationally and has taken advantage of its military and financial capabilities and support it has received over a century,
right,
to ensure that there is no voice for the Palestinian people.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Ibrahim, for sharing those thoughts with us. It's good to get a perspective from somebody who has a family that has gone through the experience and who continues to be in the area and experience the conflict. So thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you, Jamie. It was a pleasure. I wish I could have more time on air. We could certainly talk about this for days.
Let me repeat with that Ibrahim is going to be on our panel at the film, the Jewish Eyewitness in Palestine, to be shown at All Souls Unitarian Church, October 25th at 6:15. So the public is welcome, and we will have a discussion after the film for people to voice their questions and their concerns. Thank you.